Hey, this is Rob Unspach, and welcome back to another edition of E-Heroes for those keeping count. This is episode 411, and my next guest hasn't been with us for a while. If you go back to episode 338, and before that, 220. So my next guest is Tony Whatley, and we're going to make this podcast about simplicity because a lot of entrepreneurs overcomplicate what they do. So thank you for being here, Tony, and it's great to have you.
Hey, Rob. Glad to be back. And hey, cool. It's 411. Remember, that used to be like the information. That's the episode number. So we're going to give you some good information. Showing our Gen X roots here.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's but, you know, and speaking of Gen X, I saw your video about you driving a manual Pontiac shifter. And I'm like, oh, that takes back some days. I mean, it just I haven't drove stick for a long time, but.
Most of my vehicles are manual. I'd prefer them over automatics. The only time I would ever buy an automatic is if there wasn't a manual version of it available.
Well, that takes me back to a story back in the 90s. Early 90s, I worked for Coca-Cola. And on the day of my hire, they asked me if I could drive stick. And this was a Thursday. I couldn't drive stick. But I didn't want to tell them that because I didn't want to have a job. So I said, yeah, I can drive stick. And they said, can you start tomorrow? I said, no, I can start Monday, though. That weekend, I learned how to drive.
Found somebody to teach you over the weekend, huh?
Yeah, and it was on a little Pontiac, was it T100, T2000, or one of those small, kind of like a Chevette clone.
I remember those. Very disposable vehicles.
Yeah, and oh my goodness, it was my brother-in-law, too.
J2000, that's the number. That's
and it was, you know, and then there's a difference between driving a little manual small Pontiac versus a big Coke truck with the 10 bays and everything. And, you know, so I get in this thing and there's air brakes and there's like,
you know, like on the top of simplification on the cars, it's actually harder to drive a manual with a tiny little engine car because they don't have a lot of torque. Yeah. And those are more prone of stalling when you try to take off because the engine is just really weak. Bigger engines with a lot of torque actually are very simple to drive relatively compared to the small engine ones because you can let the clutch out fast or slow and the engine just got a lot of torque.
And those big Coke trucks, first shift never worked. Or first gear never worked.
So that was just to get the vehicle moving. Second. That was like one thing just to get it moving. And then you got to go to second gear right away.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, the audience is probably going, why are you talking cars? You know, but. You know, as I talked about at the very beginning, we're going to talk about simplicity. And you had this great quote on your Facebook, and it says, if you feel like you're behind, your default thought is usually to do more. And I've caught myself doing more. But many times the best path is doing less. Remove your distractions one by one and regain focus. And, you know, to use the car analogy, the stick analogy, we stayed focused as drivers because we were manual shifting. Mm-hmm. And then as we went to automatics, we have more distractions. We really do. Yeah. I mean, we got the big infotainment systems. We got this. We got that. Go back to the old cars. They were simple.
You know, it's amazing because you think about it. Even today, there are school zones where they will penalize you severely if they see you on your phone. Right. Mm-hmm. And deservedly so. It's distracted driving. But then they put all these giant monitors and screens and iPads and stuff stuck to dash. And it's like, that's actually more distracting than a little bitty phone screen. But you're just selling the cars with those things. And so it really kind of just conflicts with each other.
Yeah, I drive a Buick Enclave now. I love it. There are a lot of bells and whistles. Mm-hmm. But I have 175,000 miles on the car now.
You drive a lot, yeah.
Drive a lot. I bought it used in 2021. It had 50,000 miles, so we put a lot of miles on it. Driven it down to Florida a couple times, and it's probably the best car I've ever owned. Never had any problems with it. But you know, for years, I mean, I bought cars. In fact, I bought one when I had the cleaning business. 2005 extended GMC van within 7,000 miles, the transmission went out. Hmm. you know, and they fixed it. They it was under warranty, but you know, they don't want to service cars the way they used to, and new cars are costing. Well, the used car market is crazy right now. You know, but you know, we look at, I think as entrepreneurs, we look at all this and go on, you know, and say, oh, is a vehicle actually going to help or save, you know, my business? Will it reduce time? As with any tool that we use, you know, and now we're getting into this place where people consider AI a tool. I like it as a tool. I don't like it as anything else. But people are, oh, Rob, you can't do that. It's AI. And all the social networks are coming down against AI. And
they are.
Yeah. You know,
they're even labeling it slop. I mean, that was kind of like the jargon for a while. But now, like, there's actually filters that says, like, slop, and it won't allow it. It's kind of funny that they've adopted the.
Yeah. And the thing is, now we're all becoming junior detectives on for AI. Oh, I think that's AI. Oh, he used an M-dash. It must be AI.
Yeah.
I've been using Well,
you can
M-dash.
Tell pretty much. I mean, if you, you and I both know there's a lot of people that sound exactly the same now, where prior to AI, they were very illiterate or they misspelled things all the time, or they just weren't very good at storytelling at all. And now they all just sound very similar. Like they're like they got the same script. And yeah, it's pretty clear when someone switched it pretty quick.
Well, and now you go on LinkedIn and people are saying, yeah, I'm purposely misspelling words now to make it look like I'm human. No, you just look like you're stupid. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's, I've been an entrepreneur for 31 years and I've seen a lot of things. And I've heard people complain about a lot of things. And I think when you use a tool as a tool, and nothing more, and don't expect more from it, your life becomes easier.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we used to get that a lot. And, you know, my mechanic would say, well, I'm not buying that tool because it's too expensive. You know, or I'm getting to the age where I don't want to collect a whole bunch of new tools. And then they just sit there. I get it. You know,
yeah.
I, you know, when I had the cleaning business, I had tons and tons of tools that I just sat there.
Yep.
You know, it's supposed to make my life easier. It didn't. You know, nobody cared about the tools that I used. They just wanted the end result. Mm. And again, we're focusing on the wrong things as entrepreneurs. We need to simplify.
Yeah, you know, I think that all the technology and all the AI and all the screens and everything that's part of our everyday existence now has made a yearning for us to go back to analog, simple things. And, you know, on the topic of cars, since we were talking about that, there's even a pretty strong observation now with the younger generations, Gen Y, Gen Z, they're actually gravitating towards classic. Well, in their mind, classic is 1980s and older. But there's even some celebrities who are very well off who could afford any vehicle they want, but they're driving 1980s, mm-hmm. 1970s, 1960s cars. And these aren't usually the things that are like big time show car, $100,000 plus builds. They're just, you know, just average daily quality vehicles that they're like having fun driving around in. And mm-hmm. they're getting to play with the knobs and stuff on the radio that they weren't used to seeing because they grew up with screens in their face and cranking up windows and all this stuff. And so it's kind of cool to see the younger generations kind of gravitating towards nostalgia. And also, I would say Gen Xers are very much in that space as well, because I like the analog and the nostalgia as well. I even find myself mostly listening to 60s and 70s and 80s music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so all of the technology and all the AI and all the efficiencies and things that people have grown accustomed to, they're kind of getting tired of that. And like you talked about the messaging of people using AI and they all start to sound the same. It's very clinical and sounds like a professor professing, and nobody wants to listen to that kind of stuff. And so they're all just going back to reading physical books and kind of removing digital from their lives. And, you know, I think that's we're seeing a massive overcorrection from the massive overstimulus that was given to us ahead of time.
Yeah. You know, my younger son, he's gone through a whole slew of used cars. I mean, he beats them to death. He drives back and forth to work every day, and you know, right now he's driving a PT Cruiser, And
that's a retro style vehicle.
There's no tech, you know, there's a radio. I mean,
yeah.
And for him, that's great, you know, but, you know, he said a lot of his, and he works for a company called Rocklytics. They build stages for musicians. He's mm-hmm. really good at what he does. But he said a lot of his colleagues drive older cars.
Yeah.
They don't want the new cool. stuff. They don't want to be tracked. You know. And
they're not looking for the current modern day commuting appliance.
Well, and here's the thing is that character. I just switch insurance companies. And, you know, they're relying on the telematics or whatever it's called that my car now sends signals to them on how my driving is.
Oh, hell no.
I'm like, I don't want that. You know, and my wife doesn't drive like me. I'm a very cautious driver, mm-hmm. but she, you know, and you're supposed to get this score at least a 7 or higher on this scale. When it comes, the report comes back every month, 5. I'm like, but I'm not driving it. She is.
Yeah.
They don't care. You know, so they're building in all these things to track you and base, you know, your insurance or this or that. And I'm like, I don't want that. But I can't turn it off.
Yeah. Big Brother's even trying to pass legislation that they have these facial scanners be put mm-hmm. in your mirrors, your rearview mirrors inside. And then they can tell if you're being distracted or if you're drunk or all kinds of stuff, if you're having, you know, strange facial expressions. And so, you know, I hate to be someone that's kind of got an ugly face all the time, because then it's just going to confuse your car and they're going to think you're drunk. So, but then they want to be able to shut your car off, you know, on their dashboard, not yours.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of, I think Teslas are cool. I'm just not a fan of ever owning one.
Yeah,
I just think there's too much tracking capabilities on there, and too many stories of Tesla uploading a new update or putting a new update and it shuts your car off and now you have a brick.
Kind of like an iPhone.
Yeah. Yeah, and I still have an iPhone 12.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
what's
and
the new
beyond
model?
Beyond the update range, and so they're not breaking your phone anymore because most people have converted by now.
Yeah, it just, but you know. We have gotten to this point where I think, and maybe it's the result of COVID, but we want a simpler life.
Mm-hmm.
And as entrepreneurs, you know, yes, we've chosen to create a business, and maybe we're working longer hours than we ever did working for ourselves versus someone else, but we're not simplifying. We're complicating it. And all these people with these damn funnels who Frankenstein their system, and I'm like, Rob, how come it broke? I have no idea. What did you do? And then they want to pay me or someone else hundreds of dollars to fix. And I'm like, I don't even know where to start.
That's getting off easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so it's we need to simplify what we do. And I know that premise is hard for a lot of people. It really is.
I think the problem, Rob, is that we have all of these products and services and apps and things that are designed to create more efficient output. And so we're always focused on trying to save time. And that is important. Time is the currency of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got apps and all these things are trying to compress time and make shortcuts and then do all this stuff. But the problem is that we were smart enough to create all these things that can, you know, create more time for ourselves, but instead we just compress more work on ourselves. And so if I used to take me 3 hours to do this and AI does it in 15 seconds, instead of going, hey, I get 3 hours off a day, you start stacking all these other things in that time that you just freed up. And so now if you look at the work, like the amount of workload that we have today in 2026 versus even 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
task wise, we had a lot fewer tasks in an 8-hour workday back then because we didn't have all these efficiencies yet.
Right.
And now if you were to look just at the task list and all the different things that you got to get involved with on a daily basis because time compressed and everything's faster, so you keep stacking, it's like something like 5 times as much stuff that you're doing today on a daily basis. And it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's so many people anxious and stressed out and can't find themselves and all these problems and mental health issues like at an all-time high, it's because people have not learned to free time up and actually go do things that they enjoy. Mm-hmm. They're just adding more to the plate.
Yeah. You know, and so I admire you because the pictures that you post on social reflect that time energy that you've gained back. You know, now you get to spend doing other stuff and fixing more cars. And some of them, you know, yes, it's, you make money doing it, but it's also your passion. You love doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not trying to add more to my plate. I mean, I'm 53 now, and I've worked extremely hard not to add more to my plate. And so there's a finite limit of clients that I will work with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I have nothing on my schedule.
Right.
I like to have my entire day. I'm very busy between 8 a.m. to 1, and then I'm free, and I like to go do things that I enjoy, like whether that's going to the gym or going to the skate park or going out for a cruise or going and hanging out with a wife because we both work at home. And so I'm not out there trying to be a hustle bro and you know, crush mm-hmm. hours and brag about mm-hmm. overtime and all this other stuff like I used to do when I was stupid in my 20s.
I've been watching a person on LinkedIn. They have this product that they want to offer, like a course. And they were hoping to get at least 100 people signing up, charging them $1,500 a person. And I watched their post over a course of a couple weeks. Now they're hoping to get 50 people. And they reduced the price down to $999 instead of $1,500.
Wow.
And I'm thinking to myself, not only did you reduce the amount of people, but you reduced the price. First of all, 100 people times 1,500 is what? 150,000.
Yeah.
For me, it's easier to capture just a few people at a higher price point than it is to try to capture 100 people at a lower price point. And you've overcomplicated whatever the thing is that you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, sell a product at a higher price, capture less people, and you got less friction.
Usually the higher quality too, you get better clients, better customers who are, you know, less nitpicking and demanding, and they're more realistic. And so there's a lot of benefits to going to a higher price market.
Yeah.
The problem, and you and I both know this, the problem is that most people have low self-confidence in their skills or abilities, or they have lack of experience. And so they're afraid to charge what they're worth, because they were so worried about, you know, not being able to achieve it because they don't have that confidence yet. And so I get it. You got to start somewhere, but there's too many of you guys out there with services or products. They're selling things way below market value. And it's just really a confidence and a mindset problem.
Right. And they don't know how to convey the value.
No.
You know, it's, you know, when I do my entrepreneurial immersion events down at Disney, I have a high price ticket. And it's for a 5-day event, usually about $6,000. But I only want 10 people max.
That's right.
Because I don't want to be herding cats every morning to try to figure out where this person is. Where, look, we're all in a group. We're doing this. And these are the meals. And this is the this is where we're going. If I had more than that, I'd lose my freaking mind. You know, yeah. You try to take that many people through a park and then and have a good time. Doesn't happen. Keep the group small and things work out better. But
yeah, the quality of the room is also important to factor into that, because when you have a higher price point, yes, it will disqualify people, unfortunately. We're different socioeconomic levels.
Mm-hmm.
But the quality of that room definitely goes up whenever the price goes up. And you and I, we would still attend events, and sometimes people offer you to come to these free events or $100 events, very low ticket stuff. And you're in the room and you could just smell the desperation and the fake bravado. And people mm-hmm. are like, I'll go in the cheapest events. Like, let's talk about personal development or entrepreneurship events, things I normally would speak at. The cheapest tickets, it's kind of weird. You walk in and all these people are wearing suits that don't really fit very well, right. But they're all trying to look baller. And they're all like humble bragging about how they're crushing it and all this stuff. And then you go to an event, it's $10,000 a ticket. And Everybody's just dressed in t-shirts and jeans, and nobody's trying to flex on each other because everybody in that room is probably successful.
Well, in 2019, I think the best event that I went to was Steve Sims' event, which happened in San Francisco. Now, I did come back with COVID before they knew it was COVID.
There you go.
But Steve's events was his event was different. I mean, we got to tour Tesla. We got to, you know, tour ManyChat. We got to do all these things that were outside of the classroom that made the event so much cooler. And then you got Steve, who he looks, you know Steve, but and I've talked about Steve on this show many times. You know, yes, he did pass away last year, and I do miss him. But you look at him, and he's like, wow, he's kind of intimidating.
Yeah.
But once you get to know him, he's a teddy bear. I mean, he'll do anything for you. And that was just the type of person he was. But his events were different. And I tell people this because you can go to all these, you know, events that are low cost and you'll have thousands of people there and you won't learn a damn thing. Or you can spend a couple $1,000, go to an event that has smaller atmosphere. And you're going to learn and you're going to have fun and you're going to meet people and you're going to bond. And a lot of those people that attended that 2019 event, you still communicate with them.
That's awesome. That's good. That's real genuine connections that you made. I mean, very valuable. I mean, I've hosted 8 events now. We do them all over the world. You've seen our events. They're 3 to 4 days long, and there's only 6 hours total of speaking, and everything else is social and challenging, whether we're racing cars or whitewater rafting or hiking up mountains or touring castles. Like, we get out and we go explore, and that's how we create these things. And our target is 20 to 30 people. We don't want a 100-person event. Yeah. We want 20 to 30 people because we find that in a 3 to 4 day event, that's very good for bonding and having building really strong connections. And that's realistically what we want. We want people to become friends and become lifelong friends, like you're talking about, from being at an event. And then they're always inclined to come back and spend more time with them next year at the next event and catch up. And it's kind of like a reunion. It's cool.
Yeah. And it's simple too, because I think the simpler events produce the greatest, you know, I can't say assets or profits.
Results. We'll say results.
Outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, for sure. Because if you go to these events that are 3 days long, and there's 10 speakers every single day, and I don't care what city you're in, it could be the coolest city on paper, but if you're spending 3 days of 10 speakers a day in a conference room at a hotel, chances are you're not going to see that city anyways. You're going to see the inside of a stale hotel. And so it doesn't matter where those events are held, but you go there and it's like a fire hose. Like the first 4 or 5 speakers, you're taking notes and you're like, oh, this is great. I feel inspired. I'm going to go back and do all this stuff. And, you know, by day 2, everybody's kind of tired because they stayed up late socializing. And then by day 3, people are like tapping out or they're hungover and they're leaving early. And so if you're a day 3 speaker on one of those, like, it sucks. Like, I've been that guy. We had to pay our dues. But sometimes you go out there and, you know, there was 100 people on day 1 and now there's like 20 left and you're still going to perform what you would have done. But you're like, man, these people just don't take things seriously and they're not taking notes anymore. By that time, they're just wore out. It's that fire hose effect. And they're just drinking it and they can't handle it anymore. And it's just mental fatigue. And, you know, it's unfortunate that hosts still create events like that because it's terrible. It's terrible.
I want to make sure that when I have events that I spend time with everybody equally, you know, and it's I get it. You know, you want to create these events for maximum impact, but
most of them are trying to get maximum income, not impact.
Yeah. Or, so, you know, you go there, oh, yeah, look, I got a $47 ticket. And you get there and upsell after upsell after upsell.
Yeah, pitch missed.
And everyone's, and you walk away going, they just stole $10,000 of my money. Because that's how you feel. You have buyer's regret or remorse or whatever they want to call it. You know, whereas my event, everything's included. You know, your tickets, your food, everything. If you want to get, you know, souvenirs, that's on you. But, you know, I try to make it as easy as possible for people to say yes. And here's the thing I don't like about, I tell people, look, this is my price. You pay it, one-time payment, it's done. Mm-hmm. You can make payment arrangements with your credit card. I'm not a bank. No. But I see all these people with their programs. Oh, we'll break it down into 4 easy installments. Great. After they pay you once, they're never paying you again.
It's tough, you know, and if you lower your price point or expectations, you usually get that in result of them not showing up. They're always rescheduling or invoices go past due. And it's just, it's a hassle. Just don't do it. Let them, like you said, get a credit card, handle their own financing.
Well, you know, speaking of credit cards this year, I made the point that if your invoice is under a certain point, like say $1,000, I'll still take your credit card. But if it's over $1,000, you ACH me or you wire me.
Or add the 3%. A lot of companies are doing that now.
Yeah, I to me it's the 3% is a nickel and dime approach. I don't like doing it. I'd rather incorporate it into my fee and be done with it.
Yeah.
I don't want the customer thinking, oh my God, he's just adding more fees to me. Yeah. I just find that, you know, with an ACH or wire, I'm saving a lot of money, not credit, you know, taking that credit card, but I'm getting their money up front and they can't back charge it.
That's true.
Yeah. Now my bank charges, I think $20 for a wire.
Mm-hmm. That's common. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is common, but it's still cheaper than taking a credit card.
Especially when you get over, like you said, 1,000 at 3%. So,
yeah, it's so, you know, sometimes if you can't make more money, you got to save it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I looked at the numbers and I'm thinking, I'm paying, you know, PayPal way too much money every year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the money I'm saving makes a car payment, makes a mortgage payment. Mm-hmm. Look at those things and say, Where can I pull money out that, you know, yes, maybe I can charge more. That's great. We all love to charge more. But if you can't, where can you save it? You know, look at your systems. You're probably already overcomplicating your systems anyway. So
yeah, you got all these apps that you're paying for on subscriptions that you don't even use. Like, what are you doing? Like,
yeah,
it sounds cheap, but even streaming television's another, you know, for people are a lot of guilty with, because it's, you may have all these channels, but if you're not really watching it, like, you're just paying it. But it's like, oh, but it's only $19. But yeah, but if you got a bunch of those and they're $19, it adds up pretty quick.
Yeah, you know, I'm dealing with that with my parents right now. And they're getting older. And I looked at their cable bill and I'm like, what the heck?
$150 a month. What is it?
More than that.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, Dad, do you really need all this crap? Because my mom and dad just basically watched the was it AMC channel with
classic movies,
Hallmark and stuff, and then they watch sports, and I'm like, okay, you basically need 2 channels, and they don't know how to stream anything, so I'm trying.
They're boomer age. My parents have discovered YouTube on their television, and so YouTube has actually become one of their favorite channels, which is great because it's educational and they like to travel. So they're learning all this stuff about stuff. And you know, I enjoy watching YouTube myself, so I can't disagree.
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of RV videos. And what really gets me is those First Amendment auditors. If you ever watch those, they'll stand on a sidewalk and just film people. And the reactions of people are just...
Just trying to rage bait everybody.
Yeah. And you know, but then you also have people that go into Disney parks or Universal parks or different destinations and showcase a little bit about that. And they're making money doing it, which is great. You know, here's the thing is that since we all have these things, why not make a YouTube channel based on your likes, your dislikes, your hobbies?
Making
some extra money.
I think you should. You know, the beauty of YouTube now is like a few years ago, it changed to interest-based versus follower and algorithm-based.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could create a channel with all the stuff that you're interested in. And each piece of content, each video you make has the potential to reach know, millions of views. If it pops off and goes viral, it doesn't matter how many followers you have or subscribers you have. And so it's kind of cool. Like each piece of content is a standalone. It could get in front of a huge audience potentially.
Oh, one of my prior guests is a Disney bus driver at night, and then he's a Disney YouTuber during the day.
Oh, interesting.
So he walks around with his camera and telling people, you know, some of the duties that he has to do as a bus driver. He's giving people questions and answers, and mm-hmm. you know, and now he's getting to the point where he's got, I think, 8,000 or 9,000 followers. He's starting to get requests for sponsorships. He's starting to get, you know, paid by YouTube. I mean, mm-hmm. considerable money. And, you know, so sometimes the thing that you are known for can become the extra source of income.
Yeah, I've done that my whole life. Yeah. I've always looked to figure out how to monetize things I enjoy, especially things that we spend money on, right? You mentioned cars and things like that and travel. And so if you're already going to spend money on it, maybe you should figure out how to start a business in it and sell some of that and make money or get severe discounts on things you're going to buy anyways. Yeah. So that was one of the reasons I got into the automotive space. Is like, I knew I was going to buy car parts and modify and do all this stuff. And it's like, well, what if I, you know, become a dealer and sell some of those parts based on suggestions or when people ask for advice, I can sell that. Mm-hmm. But I can also get it at a pretty good discount. And, you know, for car parts, it's usually 25 to 40% off on some of these things. And so I was going to buy it full retail anyways. Like, that's mm-hmm. cool. I'll get a discount now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been following Dave's Auto on YouTube, and he does a lot of repairs of vehicles. And he seems like he's a very intelligent guy. And, you know, there he took, you know, the love of repair. And now he has a crew that goes around and films all this while he's, so now he's getting publicity through YouTube. He's increasing the sales through his shop. You know, he's using YouTube as a secondary way to generate more views, more likes, more income, more clientele.
Yep.
You know, and you're doing the same thing. You know, it's just, you know, we need to find a way to simplify what we're doing, but also, you know, increase the impact, the income, you know.
Yeah.
But
solve some problems, get paid.
Otherwise, you're having $1,000 piece of equipment that you're not really monetizing or optimizing or.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in more recent, you know, years, like my wife, her hobby is the travel. So all the world travel you see me doing, I have zero to do with planning any of that because that's her hobby. Mm-hmm. She loves to do that. She'll spend hours every single day on the computer looking at places to go in the world and learning all about them and what not to do and stuff like that. And so with our events, we did the first 6 events kind of at retail. I mean, we'd sign the contract and send them the money and have the event and then hope to make a profit. Usually we didn't. Mm-hmm. And then she got the idea, it's like, why don't I like become a licensed travel agent? And it's just, you know, I got to study and take, it's like real estate. You study and you take these tests and they give you an IATA number, IATA number. And then when you have that number, you can go register as a travel agent and all these different portals with all the different companies like cruises and hotels and airlines and resorts and all such. And now she gets a substantial discount for when we go there and people see us doing this and they ask for advice, she can book it for them and make commission. And so, you know, she found something that she really loves and well, let's start an LLC and just be your own travel agent. We can mm-hmm. do that too. And so now we get to benefit that from our events and also, you know, just enjoying what she's doing. Like she gets to still plan stuff for other people. She mm-hmm. was going to do that anyways.
Yeah.
But now she makes good money doing it.
Yeah, it's, you know, you got to look at the opportunity. Sometimes I think we overcomplicate that as well. Oh, what if it makes me too much money? What if it does this? What if it takes me away from the family? Yeah, but none of that's happened yet.
No. If anything, you get to work at home. Like, you'd be around family all you want.
You know, I love, and this is, you know, I've had this agency for 25 years, been an entrepreneur for 31. I love this point in my life where I can take my clients, you know, on events. I can take them, you know, to out of country. I can, you know, this is great. You know, because I'm mixing my love of travel with marketing, with education, with teaching, and you know, you're doing the same thing. You know, I love to travel, but I need to be able to find a way that I can do it, you know, and teach and you know, going to some of these countries. I was in southern France 2 years ago, and it's wonderful, you know, just wonderful to get away and discover other places, discover culture. But, you know, all people want to do now is, oh, well, I just, you know, I got to get on social media and tell the world what? You didn't do anything.
That's it. You know, one of the best kept secrets, which unfortunately is a secret, is that there's a lot of benefits to being a business owner. And so when people are comparing themselves and watching other people enjoying their travels and the nice cars or the luxury lifestyle and things that we see, you got to realize that you have really low likelihood of ever achieving those things as an employee somewhere. It's very low likely. I mean, I was a high paid employee in my corporate career. I left in 2015, but I also owned businesses since 2001 while I was working, and that mm-hmm. businesses made more than my corporate career did. And so I got to see a lot of my peers never get to take vacations because they got to raise their hand to ask permission to take time off anyways, and you only get X amount of weeks per year. And so I realized quickly, like, if I wanted to achieve more things and be able to experience the world and do things on my own schedule, I have to take control of my schedule. And the only way you can do that is be your own business owner, be self-employed, figure out how to make money like that. And so, you know, one of the best kept secrets when you see this stuff is understanding that as a business owner, we get a lot of invoices and we pay a lot of bills every month, right? Whether that's payroll or rent or whatever. So thousands, hundreds of thousands sometimes, maybe even $1 million a month if your company's big enough. And if we're using the points system, which everybody has access to, but think about this, if you're an employee and you're just buying groceries once a month, you're spending, you know, $400 or $500 a month on your card and you're getting some airline miles and maybe hotel points or rewards. And so it takes forever to accumulate anything worthwhile. But let's say, like, I'm a business owner and I've got a airline card. We use United because we're in Houston. It's a hub. Mm-hmm. My wheel business sells over $100,000 a month in wheels. And I'm using that card every single month to pay for those and then drafting and paying it out of my bank account. Mm-hmm. I'm earning a crap ton of points every single month. And so you see me always flying around and standing in all these nice places. A lot of times it's free. Mm-hmm. It's free on transactions I was going to pay anyways, whether I used a debit card or ACH or my points card. And so all the business owners out there that are paying these big bills, sometimes, like I said, six figures a month, we're racking up crazy travel points and rewards, and we can use those for free. Where an employee's like, man, I wish I could afford that. But yeah, you can. Right. Go start a business, pay some bills with your cards, and you'll be traveling too.
Yeah, I just looked at my one card, and I still have 100,000 miles on American Airlines.
Yeah, you can go across the ocean and back.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and then one card we just got gives me 5% on groceries. Well, heck yeah. Yeah. Groceries are expensive, but, you know, yeah, I could get points. Points are good. Awards are good. But 5% back? Pretty good too.
No, I'm taking the point. I'll take the airlines and the hotels because we're going to use them. Like you said, you like to travel. I'd rather get rewarded on something I enjoy versus groceries, which is a need.
Yeah. Sometimes though, you look at it and you're, okay, does United fly there? Does American fly there? And a couple of times we've been to, you know, Europe. Mm-hmm. I'm not flying on American. I'm flying, you know.
Yeah, you gotta, sometimes you got to connect and be a little crafty, but, you know, luckily we live in a hub and it's, you know, Houston goes everywhere. So.
Yeah. You know, I've flown into Dallas a few times, Love Field once.
Yeah.
But never into Houston. Maybe I did.
You may have connected at some point. I mean,
I think I did. I never left Houston. I got stranded there for 10 hours.
Oh, dang.
Waiting for a connection flight from there to El Paso. Mm. And, yeah, we were going to my son's wedding 2016, 10 years ago. Yeah. But yeah, I try to use my points, you know, my cards everywhere. One of the things I tell my kids is never use your debit card because there's no protections on it.
No, they'll drain your bank account nowadays. So, good luck getting that back.
I know that we're running out of time. Where can people find you? Where do they go?
365driven.com. That's my website. And I'm all over the internet. So you can just, you know, look me up, Tony Whatley, and you'll find all my posts and the stuff I put out there. And
yeah, it's good stuff.
See some of the stuff I enjoy.
Yeah. Hey, I want to thank everyone for listening. And please, you know, go over to Tony's site, learn about him, you know, find him on Facebook and interact, because he's a nice guy. He's one of the last Boy Scouts out there, and you know, he'll treat you right. So, guys, we'll catch you guys on the next episode. Adios.